It is Monday, November 26, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Support for KUAF comes from Walton Art Center and the 10x10 Art Series, featuring All is Calm, the Christmas Truce of 1914, Thursday night at 7. This holiday musical recalls the World War I truce between Allied and German forces in No Man's Land on Christmas Eve, 1914. Tickets and information available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600. Support also comes from Eureka Springs, the Victorian Mountain Village, featuring art, music, dining, lodging, various attractions, and outdoor activities. Information, including a visitor's vacation planner, an events calendar, newsletter registration, and more, available on the web at eurekasprings.org. Ahead on Ozarks, how food and explosive population growth in Fayetteville might be related. We'll find out how research at the University of Arkansas is creating a plan to make a larger city self-sustainable when it comes to food. Plus, the Ozarks Chorale spends most Tuesdays inside a middle school cafeteria working toward public concerts. But first, if you drove through Springdale yesterday, you may now be aware that liquor stores in the city began Sunday alcohol sales yesterday. The Sunday sales come after the Washington County Election Commission last week certified the vote on the issue, in which voters in the city approved by a 52-48% margin, a margin of fewer than 600 votes. As per the new law, Springdale liquor stores are allowed to sell liquor between the hours of 10 a.m. and midnight on Sundays. At the beginning of last month, the Fayetteville Farmers Market petitioned the Fayetteville City Council to amend its vending and peddling ordinance so the market at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks could have extended days and hours of operation. The council voted unanimously to amend the ordinance, leaving one more procedural hurdle for the market to overcome. Senior city planner Andrew Garner says that although the farmers market is the sole business allowed to operate for profit in city parks, the expanded operations of the farmers market requires planning commission approval.
If the commission approves it, they could go ahead and start immediately. They have an existing permit to be at the botanical gardens, and what they're mainly wanting to do, they're wanting to change their permit slightly to allow for a really large, like a fireworks tent type thing to be installed at the Lake Fayetteville Park in this meadow right next to the botanical gardens. So adding the tent is one of the reasons they're having to go back to the commission.
At its meeting earlier this month, the Planning Commission tabled the issue. Senior city planner Andrew Garner says that some commissioners were concerned about where market customers would park.
There's a stream that's really close to the area. It's going to be just kind of in an open meadow, and where people were parking, it wasn't really clear on the documents that were turned in how close they were going to be to the stream. And the city does have a streamside protection ordinance, and so I think they wanted to have the farmers market confirm exactly where the parking areas were going to be.
The issue was tabled at the request of the farmers market because only five planning commissioners were present at the November 13th meeting. The request needed five votes to pass, and representatives from the farmers market wanted to wait for a vote by the full planning commission to help the request's chances of success. The planning commission will meet this evening at 5:30. Governor Mike Beebe is encouraging Arkansans to receive flu vaccines. He says it's one of the best ways to protect yourself and others, especially those with higher risks of getting the flu, like pregnant women, children, and seniors. In his weekly radio address, the governor says he's pleased with improvement the state has made in the past year.
In 2011, about 1.3 million people received the flu vaccine in our state. That's closing in on almost half our population. As impressive as that number is, even more impressive is our progress. Arkansas had the largest single-year increase in overall flu immunizations of any state in the union. We jumped from 27th place in 2010 to 10th place in just 1 year.
The governor says he hopes there will be even more people receiving flu shots this year. Vaccines are available at pharmacies and health providers throughout the state. Last week, the Fayetteville Town and Gown Committee met, and during the meeting, they weighed in on a University of Arkansas request for funding from the city's Advertising and Promotion Commission. At issue is a $1 million request that the University of Arkansas has put in to help build a performing arts center on the U of A campus. The Town and Gown Committee voted 10-3 in favor of the A&P Commission awarding the funding to the university, but just to the tune of $125,000 semi-annually. Steve Clark is the president of the Fayetteville Chamber of Commerce and a member of the Town and Gown Committee. He says the committee's decision was made based on the idea that the university is a major economic engine in the city.
And it's not just around athletics. It's around the arts and culture and history and development of skills. So whether it's the Walton College of Business with the various seminars that they put on, or it's the School of Fine Arts and the saxophone ensembles or the symphony music that they do, or it's the School of Agriculture and it's the hands-on training they provide for the farmers and others in our community who are involved in food production, crop production, or it's the law school and who's bringing in lawyers from across the state to keep abreast of current changes in the law. The university is every day contributing to the economic development of Fayetteville.
The Town and Gown Committee is comprised of members of the university, city appointees, and city residents. Though the committee reached a majority in its recommendation to the A&P Commission, the city appointees on the committee abstained from the vote, stating concerns that recommending a dollar amount to be awarded to the university was out of the purview of the committee. The Advertising and Promotion Commission is expected to take up the issue again at its meeting next month. Tomorrow morning, traffic will be opened onto the completed sections of the new roundabout at North Hills Boulevard near Washington Regional Medical Center. Traffic will be restricted to one lane as construction crews continue to finish converting the intersection from a four-way stop. According to the city, the project is expected to be completed by the end of this year. The University of Arkansas Razorback volleyball team is ending a six-year absence from the NCAA Division I Women's Volleyball National Championship Tournament. Yesterday, Arkansas was invited to the tournament as an at-large team. The Razorbacks will open tournament play Friday afternoon against Wichita State in the sub-regional that takes place in Lawrence, Kansas. The other two teams in that sub-regional are number 11 national seed Kansas and Cleveland State. Should the Razorbacks win Friday, they would continue play for at least another round in Lawrence, Kansas. Partly cloudy tonight. Low will be 34 in the Arkansas River Valley, dipping to 23 in northwest Arkansas. Tomorrow, clear, high in the lower 50s. And for Tuesday night, clear, lows near 30 in the Arkansas River Valley and mid-20s tomorrow night for northwest Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large. Leading up to Black Friday last week, union organizers behind a Walmart employee strike boasted 1,000 demonstrations would occur across 46 states to protest unfair labor conditions at the world's largest retailer. By late Friday, it was clear a massive demonstration never materialized. Still, dozens of protests did occur. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich spent part of her holiday tracking the protests for Ozarks at Large as well as NPR, and she has this report.
Occupy Walmart was the first strike of its kind in Walmart's 50-year history, but it was nowhere near historic in proportions. The final tally is not clear because the Responsible Employee Protest Group, Organization for Respect at Walmart, or Our Walmart, never provided one, nor did the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, which formed Our Walmart more than a year ago. But Walmart was certainly keeping watch. Starting Thursday night when Black Friday sales deployed at 8 p.m. at supercenters across the country, store managers were logging protest counts to corporate. Here's Walmart spokesperson Corey Lumberg reporting midday Friday.
We saw only 26 protests occur at stores, and many of them did not include any Walmart associates. And we estimate that really less than 50 associates participated in the protests nationwide during that time.
No Walmart employees struck in northwest Arkansas, but members from a workers' justice center did demonstrate over the weekend in front of a Springdale store. But hundreds of Walmart associates did walk off the job in states like California, Wisconsin, Florida, Georgia, and Maryland. In a midday Friday media conference call, Our Walmart director, Dan Schlederman, claimed the protest was in full force in 1,000 cities across 46 states, but when pressed, he couldn't provide an exact number.
There are walkouts still happening throughout the day. And there's also, lots of reports of workers who are not protesting going to work by not necessarily showing up to the picket line or showing up at Walmart. So we honestly don't, this is open source striking. This is something that is going to take us time to exactly know. We know there are hundreds and hundreds of workers on strike as we speak, but the actual number is unknown at this point, and because it continues to grow.
And protester Colby Harris from Dallas, Texas, who patched into the call, said the movement is just taking root.
And I just like to say the reason why I joined this is because I saw how unfair a lot of the soldiers were getting treated, and just the struggle to make it from check to check. A lot of people are fearful of you know, retaliation. And I think that with us being so bold and coming out and speaking up, that people are gaining a lot of confidence and seeing that, you know, you can protest and you can speak out and you're still going to have your job. And a lot of people in the neighborhoods and a lot of the media has picked up our story. And, you know, we've already won, guys. You know, these are small victories, quote unquote, but Walmart's already showing that, you know, at some point they're going to fold.
In several press releases throughout the day, Walmart restated that reports of any mass demonstrations were being greatly exaggerated, and it was holiday business as usual. The company also lauded associates who stayed the course, giving them special discounts and holiday pay. But even before word of a nationwide strike got out, Walmart had filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board seeking an injunction to block the protest. In their complaint to the NLRB, Walmart claimed that the Black Friday event and other sporadic demonstrations staged over the past month were orchestrated by the UFCW union, which is illegal because Walmart is not a union shop. Our Walmart reportedly filed its own complaint with the labor board, claiming it was not about labor organizing, and protesting Walmart associates were being subjected to retaliations. A National Labor Relations Board spokesperson in an email for this story said a decision is still pending. And so the protest proceeded as scheduled. Rumors also circulated that Walmart managers were ordered by corporate to pressure associates from joining the Black Friday protest. In a statement to Ozarks at Large, the company denied such a memo exists. But early in the week, a spokesperson did warn that workers would face consequences if they walked out. One of the largest protests, numbering between 600 to 1,000 strong, took place at a Paramount, California superstore. That's where Dan Hindeman works.
We're not trying to tell Walmart shut down or go union. No, we're not asking for none of that. We're asking for better livable wages for my family. You know, give us better, you know, child care, insurance. I mean, just help us live like human beings. I'm a human being. We have that right to survive, and if we work hard, we should be compensated for it. That should be a human moral, you know?
Hindeman claims his hours have been cut from 36 to 15 because he's speaking out. Still, the 28-year-old electronic sales associate says he loves his job and hopes the company will get the message. Complaints about low pay, capricious scheduling, and costly health benefits are chronic among the big box retailer. Median retail pay, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, is $10.09 per hour, or nearly $21,000 per year. But Walmart, with 1.3 million U.S. workers at 4,500 stores, is a leading low-wage employer. The company does not disclose the numbers, but sales associates self-report earnings, on average, to be $8.70 per hour. Minimum wage is $7.25 per hour. Strikers seek an across-the-board living wage increase, more hours, more fixed scheduling, and affordable benefits. Walmart has long claimed its compensation is competitive and benefits are generous. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The week of Thanksgiving is a business paradox. The long holiday weekend means a shorter work week for many, but the day after Thanksgiving retail frenzy provides one of the biggest business days of the year. Roby Brock, with our content partner Talk Business, takes a look back at the business and political news of Arkansas from the previous week.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business Update, a recap of the biggest business and political headlines of the last week. Arkansas's October jobless rate rose 1/10 of a point to 7.2% as the number of unemployed workers grew by an estimated 4,700. U.S. unemployment in October was 7.9%. 1 year ago, Arkansas's unemployment rate stood at 8%. Now, October marked the 45th consecutive month that the state's jobless rate hovered above 7%. Meat giant Tyson Foods saw its profits double in the fourth quarter despite a small slip in overall sales. The Springdale-based chicken, pork, and beef processor reported quarterly net income of $185 million. That's up from $97 million 1 year ago. Revenues were down for the quarter to $8.37 billion compared to $8.4 billion in the previous year. For its full fiscal year, which ended September 29th, Tyson Foods profits cleared $583 million on revenues of $33.28 billion, One year ago, Tyson Foods reported net income of $750 million on sales of $32.27 billion. A tough quarter of sales pushed profits lower for America's Car Mart. The Bentonville-based used car dealer posted net income of $7.28 million on revenue of a little more than $110 million. One year ago, Car-Mart recorded net income of $7.76 million on sales that were just about the same, a little over $110 million. An item tucked inside Walmart's routine quarterly earnings report noted that an investigation of corruption practices, once limited to the company's Mexican operations, has been expanded. Inquiries or investigations regarding allegations of potential Foreign Corrupt Practices Act violations have been commenced in a number of foreign markets where we operate, including but not limited to Brazil, China, and India, Walmart said in a statement in its earnings report. The Arkansas Policy Foundation is renewing its call for tax cuts that could reduce state collections by $88.5 million. The foundation proposed cutting the individual income tax rate from 7% to 6.75%, which would reduce state revenues by an estimated $45 million. Reducing the sales tax on groceries by 0.5% would reduce state revenues by $25 million. The think tank also said cutting the capital gains tax in Arkansas by 10% could reduce state revenues by $9.25 million. And a new study shows that small businesses have been the primary driver of job growth in the Delta area of Arkansas and the U.S. as larger employers have left the region. The report, which was completed by the Delta Regional Authority and Southeast Missouri State University, analyzed unique data from Dun & Bradstreet's information to assess key trends driving employment. Findings from the study include: more than 90% of the new net Delta jobs over the past 20 years have been created by local small businesses of 9 or fewer employees. During the years of the Great Recession, local small businesses created over 58,000 new jobs. And during that same period, non-commercial and non-residential establishments eliminated nearly 368,000 jobs. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. When we think about the future, we often picture flying cars, robots, images from Back to the Future, the cartoon The Jetsons, or perhaps a dystopian society from movies like Demolition Man. Well, lucky for us, the Community Center Design Center at the University of Arkansas has received a grant from the American Institute of Architects in partnership with the Clinton Global Initiative and the Association of Collegiate Schools of Architecture as part of the Decade of Design program. And because of this, the Community Design Center is able to provide a much more realistic look at Fayetteville's future. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas has more.
Imagine Fayetteville with a population of 135,000, not counting university students. If the current growth rate of 2.7% continues, that's how many people will be living within these city limits. That's according to a report conducted by the University of Arkansas Little Rock's Business School. The mission of the University of Arkansas Fayetteville's Community Design Center is to promote creative development through education, design, and research. That organization has been working with the City of Fayetteville to develop Fayetteville 2030, a scenario plan. Scenario planning was introduced about 60 years ago. Often used by military and transportation, it's common in Europe, though not widely used in the U.S. Rather than a comprehensive plan, scenario planning looks at issues of growth and drivers of growth through what-if scenarios. Steve Luoni, director of the Community Design Center, has more.
And so these are not proposals for what the city has to do. What the scenario does is allow the decision-making culture of the community. That includes the university, the cities, developers, anyone involved in planning, to look at the issues that the city may confront in the next 30 years, which are hard to anticipate. So what scenario planning does, rather than lay out what we should do, it lays out the issues and things that we might consider so that we make the decision-making culture of the place smarter about how to allocate resources.
Fayetteville 2030 is a multi-year project involving different scenarios.
The first Fayetteville 2030, Transit City, looked at the role of the streetcar in public transit in organizing future growth. Fayetteville is growing outward, sprawling. Rail is one way to concentrate the population. If the city does nothing, it's predicted 300 miles of new roads will be built in the next 20 years. Luoni says the one way to address future cities is the collaboration of transportation and land use, which currently isn't on the board in most places. This current project, Food City, is a follow-up to that. The center's assistant director, Jeffrey Huber, explains how the food scenario fits in.
What if that development that was coming by 2030 was incented to organize itself around a productive food network that could sustain itself, as well as what we're finding through our metrics, the rest of the city, through growing food through an urban agricultural network? And so, you know, that's what's at stake, is 300 miles of new roads at a cost of $600 million is what we were just finding with just those new roads. That doesn't include, again, all the sewer services and everything else that the city would have to put in, install, and maintain over the course of years to come.
They say that local food networks play a large role in the health, sustainability, and resilience of a city. Luoni says that when looking at the scenario, resiliency is important.
How resilient, how stable are current settlement patterns such that when electricity does get cut off, if supplies to food get cut off, the withdrawal of credit from the market, perhaps energy shortages or lower energy future, are infrastructure prepared to handle those sorts of drivers of instability?
Food City looks at what if 100% of Fayetteville's future growth had to be supported from a local food network. This allows them to make a footprint of what that would look like. As beef eaters in the U.S., 2.1 acres are needed per person per year to support nutritional needs. Changing with diet and location, compare that to the tenth of an acre that is needed in Cuba.
Right now, their study shows it would take 147,000 acres of land just to support 135,000 people that are coming to Fayetteville by 2030.
Keep it in mind that the city of Fayetteville's only 30,000 acres, so we would need five times the size of the city just to support pasture-raised beef.
If we took beef out of the metrics, all of the nutritional needs of the city could be met with just 40,000 acres, making it much more feasible to look at the current acreage of 35,000 and actually have an urban agricultural network throughout the city that could support our nutritional needs. But how does that work if there are roads and buildings on that land? Huber explains.
A public right-of-way, for instance, a street, it can easily go ahead and, instead of planting an ornamental tree, that tree can actually be flipped over to produce a nut or produce some sort of fruit or some kind of high-value product on it that is essentially space we already use. It's just moving it from an ornamental purpose to a productive purpose. And so those are the kind of techniques and ways that we want to look at embedding an urban agricultural system in the city, is utilize the places that are already there. Why can't a riparian corridor be a cool foraging network that also has a trail system associated with, where you can go and kind of, as a hunter-gatherer network, you can go through there and kind of get all the food products you may need?
Whether food insecure or a local foodie, no matter the budget, there will be something for everyone in this urban agricultural network, from high-quality products to highly forageable products. Luoni points out that this plan is also an economic development tool, because value-added food products are being grown locally, processed locally, marketed locally, and distributed locally.
Because what it does is it brings higher value than what you would find from industrial farming. And there's a real market for that now.
This goes back to resiliency, being less reliant on those industrial farms. Four farms produce 80% of our nation's spinach. What would happen if just one of those went out of business? Fayetteville already has some edible landscapes. There are greens on the square, herbs in Wilson Park. It's a matter of amplifying that, getting more individuals and businesses on board. Huber mentions a farm meadow project that's taking off nationwide.
And their initiative to actually have a website that links retailers with distributors with people that actually want food products, whether you're growing or you're buying it out of a CSA, community supported agriculture program, or if you're a restaurant. I think those are the great opportunities that allow for the bringing this to the 21st century and having these kind of networks in place that if you do have a plot of land where you're growing spinach, that you can somewhat figure out these kind of share programs where you can actually just, you know, trade your products around town. So maybe you're good at one thing. Well, that's how, you know, you as an individual, but I think even if you didn't want to grow anything at all, you should know where these markets are. And that's what the Food City scenario wants to do is set up neighborhood markets around town to where people know where to get access to local food.
As the Community Design Center is associated with the U of A, Luoni and Huber are working with architecture students to help develop their plan. Fifth-year students may take the option to get studio hours at the center, working on the Food City scenario for an entire semester. Close to 10 students are working on the off-campus studio on this sunny afternoon just before Thanksgiving break. While their projects might not wind up in the final product, they are contributing, both to the plan as a whole and their grade. Ryan Pruitt, a fifth-year student, explains what his approach to the Fayetteville 2030 Food City scenario is.
Okay, what I'm working on is just how to integrate food into the city of Fayetteville, into a fabric that's already here. I'm working particularly with like this neighborhood around the Martin Luther King and 540 intersection and what that would look like with all this food. 100,000 acres stretching all the way to Farmington and Lincoln, all this agriculture that would come into the city and how it doesn't just like stop at the city and it turns urban, but it actually, the food comes into the city and begins to make spaces where people can interact and run around.
He envisions pockets of agriculture around which people want to live. He uses a computer program to map his ideas, as well as 3D models and drawings.
So for instance, in my drawings, I have all these, this really strong line that seems like the agriculture stops, but then I have these lines that continue into the city, and then they turn into these huge squares and public spaces where, you know, you can imagine kids playing around, and we joke around about corn mazes, but and underneath orchards, sitting underneath trees, you have mega trees, you have nut trees lining the streets, and then all around these orchards, you have like these living houses where people can look out their living room windows and just look out over a sea of trees and a sea of apples and fruits. And a lot of these vertical surfaces, especially like ones facing south, you can use to grow vines and use the sun all times.
Residents could literally reach out their window and grab fruits and berries. Pruitt's approach is more regional, incorporating the surrounding more rural towns. To see what Fayetteville's Food City will really look like, I guess we'll have to wait a few, or 17 years. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
In the end, Israel and Hamas signed on to a ceasefire, but winners and losers in this conflict stretch from Cairo to Ankara to Tehran and Washington, D.C. I'm Neil Conan, the winners and losers after the latest Middle East conflict, plus our weekly read of the opinion page. Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon at 1 on KUAF 91.3 FM. This fall, nearly 400 people took advantage of a one-stop health and service clinic called Hope 2012. It was at Central United Methodist Church in Fayetteville. It was the fourth annual such day-long event that allowed for eye exams, dental exams, blood pressure readings, and similar screenings. The outreach is intended for people in Northwest Arkansas, including low-income families and individuals, the homeless population, and veterans. The partnership behind the event includes the Veterans Administration, United Way of Northwest Arkansas, Seven Hills Homeless Center, Central United Methodist Church in Fayetteville, and the Community and Family Institute at the University of Arkansas. Kevin Fitzpatrick holds the Jones Chair in Community in the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the U of A, and last week he came to our studio to explain what happened and what was learned at Hope 2012.
It's sort of unique in the sense that we deliver services one place, one time a year. But I also think that for a lot of people, and I think we've seen this now 3 years, certainly 3 years running, that these are people that this is their one time a year. They get to see the dentist or they get to see the optometrist. And before we started this, there were people that said that they had not seen an eye doctor ever, they had not seen a dental hygienist ever. So we really believe that by inserting something, even at one day, it's clearly making a difference for some people, hundreds of people.
Many of them had not seen an optometrist or dental hygienist because they don't have insurance.
Right. And again, we've had this conversation before where even the people that do carry a medical insurance don't carry a dental rider, mm-hmm. oftentimes don't carry an eye rider. Now some of those will have – you can go to the optometrist once a year, but most don't have a dental rider. So there are a lot of people in Northwest Arkansas and around the country that have insurance but don't have dental insurance and oftentimes are not going to the dentist regularly.
Well, if you do have a dental or eye rider, that doesn't mean that you can walk in, sit down, and leave without paying.
Right.
I mean, it'll cover something, but
that's right.
You might have to pay a lot more.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And so in this case, what we're able to do is we're able to connect people to services that they have an opportunity to connect to, but there's a procedure that makes it difficult for them to connect to. So by seeing these patients at Hope, we're able to, through the generous offering of the Northwest Arkansas Free Clinic, get those patients in a timely manner, have their teeth further examined, and if needed, extracted. And of course, we want them to be able to work towards not only finding a medical home, but a dental home. But, you know, we do see this as sort of a quick fix, but an important one, because some of these folks have been walking around suffering and in pain for months while they're trying to get their teeth attended to.
You also blood pressure readings and many other readings to find out if someone has hypertension or what other potential health problems they might have.
Yeah, I think we see this as also a good opportunity to do community screening, health screening for what I consider to be the population that's not likely to show up at the mall when they do a health screening.
Right.
And so I think by serving that population, we're able to potentially prevent and intervene in a process that even if somebody is already hypertensive, we may find out that, well, you're still hypertensive, but maybe they're not taking their drugs. So we can then possibly connect them to either a primary care physician or Walgreens, who happened to be there this year giving out free flu shots, and see if we can't do something with that as well. So it may be we need to find out if they have it. Maybe we need to see if something needs to be done in addition, even though they may be monitoring their blood pressure or glucose or whatever.
There are voluntary interviews that that the clients can participate in. This helps give you a sociological sort of idea of Northwest Arkansas as well.
Oh, absolutely. Not only a sociological one, but just a practical one.
Yeah.
This really helps providers have a better understanding from the health perspective what this particular population looks like. And, you know, we do the point-in-time census, which is coming up in January of 2013. And that gives us some insight into this population. But this expands our knowledge, not only in terms of being able to drill down a little bit closer on health issues, but also on a population that is at risk but may not be homeless. Because we see probably, you know, not quite half, I'd say probably 60% actually, that we saw this year were not homeless. So even though the original design was to attend to homeless and homeless vets, there are a lot of people who are neither one of those, still in need, still at risk, that we're serving, so that we're getting some data on this population that we'd never had before, because they don't end up getting into the point-in-time census or some of the other data collections we've done.
The point-in-time census is when you go out and...
That's right. We actually go out 24-hour period, Northwest Arkansas, Washington, Benton County, sort of cast the net over the region and go to all those locations where either they're providing services directly to homeless or we know that they're providing services to homeless and others as well. So, that's an important part of this continuing this continuing ability, I think, for our region to understand this population better than a lot of regions who aren't engaging in this kind of data collection.
When you look at the HOPE 2012 report compared to the previous year, you get a lot of the same sort of 57% have no insurance. Mm-hmm. A similar amount.
We do. We continue to see the same people.
Yeah.
And in some ways that they're not changing. And you know, for some of these issues, they need to be changing. We need to be able to see fewer and fewer people when it comes to direct services. But until we begin to change the landscape for the accessibility to those services, you're still going to have 70% of the people that we see don't see a dentist. I mean, they just did not see a dentist in the last year. So, again, until we find a way to plug that gap, you're going to continue to see those numbers stay pretty uniform across from year to year.
And is that the long-term benefit from this sort of collection of data? Is like you can physically show in a report this is...
I think so. I think that's part of it. I mean, we'd like to be able to say that we're seeing some change as well, but this has been all along my intent, not only for HOPE and the kinds of reports that we generate from it, but also from the point in time is to make sure that the region and policymakers and funders and those folks that provide services understand their population, you know, understand the population that they serve. Because I really think that in order to develop effective policy and understand the trajectory of populations like homeless or near homeless, you really have to have a good understanding of specifically what those problems are, because it's so complicated and it's so multidimensional that you know, you could have a whole group of people, their primary concern and their primary issues are about health, where you could have another group, depending on age or background, where that may not be their number one issue. It may be more about housing or something else. So I think, yeah, I think it's important that we continue to work really hard at understanding the population. We can do no wrong in servicing that group by knowing more about them.
You mentioned the Northwest Arkansas Free Health Center. In 2000, they had 2,000 patient visits. Last year, 2011, they had 11,500.
Wow, that even surprises me. That's unbelievable. And again, I just, it drives home the point that we need health care for people who can't afford it. And you know that we've talked about this before. And you know, we're working really hard to bring dental care, free dental care, to Northwest Arkansas using a mobile system, and I think that, you know, that also is something that we need, because imagine of the 11,000 people, how many other folks needed that care in Northwest Arkansas that couldn't even get to the free clinic. Mm-hmm. So
or don't know about
or
it.
Don't or don't know about it, or yeah, and again, or couldn't fit into the schedule because they have planned scheduling. So it, I mean, the need is there. I mean, the need is all over the country. There are some things that I think that make that need a little bit more heightened here in Northwest Arkansas, but the need is clearly a countrywide one.
This may not be a fair question. It's certainly an awkward one, but is it? Do you think it's more important to get this information in the hands of legislators, people who will determine laws and policy, or people who vote for legislators?
Good question. If I really felt like, I mean, because this to me is really, this is at the heart of it, because one of the things that I really have felt, particularly as we have gone over these last few months through the election period, is that I'm not sure that people spend enough time thinking about who they should send to Little Rock or who they should send to Washington. You know, I spent way too much time thinking about who the president should be. Way too much time. I think it's important, but I think we maybe ought to spend way more time thinking about those individuals. And so I think it is important, particularly at local and state level. But I think we need to be a lot more cognizant of who we're sending, who can really impact and make decisions that could assist and address problems like the ones we're talking about here. So I think, long story long answer, I think it's important that the local voter understand the issues, because that ought to inform their decision about who they send. I also think that it's important that the local voter just understand the issues. Mm-hmm. So, because they have lots of influence, they can influence their church, they can influence their book club, they can influence. I mean, there's a lot of spheres of influence for any individual when it comes to getting behind a particular problem are incredible. And you can see Northwest Arkansas. We have plenty of examples of this, of people who, when they get it in their mind that they're going to make a difference, they do everything. They pull out all the stops, whether they're connected or not.
Kevin Fitzpatrick holds the Jones Chair in Community in the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. The Community and Family Institute at the U of A helped sponsor this fall's HOPE 2012 event. Most Tuesday evenings, about 50 people from across Northwest Arkansas and Southwest Missouri gather together inside the cafeteria at Eureka Springs Middle School. The first order of business is some friendly visiting, followed by vocal warm-up exercises. The Ozarks Chorale is a community-based ensemble that has been singing together for more than 17 years. Members drive to the school on Tuesday nights, not just from homes in nearby Eureka, but from Berryville, Green Forest, Fayetteville, Madison County, Holiday Island, and small communities in Missouri like Shell Knob. Paul Gandy is the president of the board of directors for the chorale and one of the voices in the chorale. He's been associated with the group for about 4 years because he says he likes to sing.
Years ago, my brothers and I, I'm a member of four brothers, I'm the eldest, had a gospel quartet back in Louisiana at home, enjoyed it, and learned the bass part. And from there, a sincere just joy of singing and learning about music was part of what I wanted to do.
Paul says most of the members of the Ozarks Chorale bring some level of singing experience to the rehearsals. Certainly everybody brings a deep love for singing to the all-volunteer chorale.
The most significant thing that everybody comes here with is they want to sing. It's a volunteer civic choir. You don't have to be here, but everybody comes back. It's fun, and the joy the reward of learning something every Tuesday that you can take home personally that you knew, that you now know you didn't know, and that you can also, as a group, perform for the benefit of others, has its own rewards.
While the Ozarks Chorale performs throughout the year, the Christmas season is especially busy. There has already been a public concert at Holiday Island, and this Friday night, the chorale is scheduled to perform inside the chapel at Jones Center for Families in Springdale. Beth Withy, the artistic director and conductor for the chorale, says the holiday season just has a natural connection to singing.
There's something about the holiday season that triggers memories in people, childhood memories, adult memories, and certain songs that trigger those memories that make people happy. And there's something about the crisp autumn and Christmas air, I think, that it just makes you feel like singing and having a cup of cocoa.
Beth Beth Withy says the chorale has been working hard to fine-tune their performances that are scheduled over the next couple of weeks.
This season for Christmas, we've chosen really upbeat, rhythmic pieces, something that is fun to set off the holiday season, as well as a few of the really classical pieces like a Mozart Alleluia and an Ave Maria by Rachmaninoff. So we think we have a very varied program this year.
She says rehearsal after rehearsal, the hard work for the community ensemble is paying off. The goal is to provide an evening's enjoyment for an audience, of course, but chorale members say they benefit even more. That singing together, whether in the Eureka Springs Middle School cafeteria or on stage at the auditorium in downtown Eureka, can be a rewarding personal experience. Again, Beth Withy, the artistic director and conductor for the Ozarks Chorale.
Part of what I think the joy is of singing together is that we actually feel the music in a different way. And the more of us there are, the more sort of that joyous feeling we get. But there's also a strong feeling of accomplishment when you've done something together and you know it's really fine and your best work. Of course, there's teamwork. It's just a real strong feeling of accomplishment.
The Ozarks Chorale will perform Friday night at the Jones Center for Families in Springdale beginning at 7:30. They'll also sing at the Crescent Hotel on December 6th, that's a Thursday night, at 6:30, and at the Odd in downtown Eureka Springs, December 8th. That concert begins at 7:30. You can learn more at the website theozarkschorale.org.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 26th of November, 2012. It's the birthday of the novelist Marilyn Robinson, born Sand Point, Idaho, 1943. Her first novel, 1980, Housekeeping, story of two sisters in a town called Fingerbone, Idaho. Their mother commits suicide. Their aunt moves back to town to take care of them. Marilyn Robinson went off to teach at the University of Kent in England. She learned about a nuclear facility dumping toxic waste into the Irish Sea, which resulted in unusually high rates of cancer among local children. She wrote a book about it called Mother Country. Came back to this country, University of Iowa, wrote her second novel, Gilead, in 2004. An epistolary novel, series of letters from a dying 76-year-old Congregationalist pastor in the town of Gilead, Iowa, in which Marilyn Robinson wrote, "Sometimes I have loved the peacefulness of an ordinary Sunday. It is like standing in a newly planted garden after a warm rain. All it needs from you is that you take care not to trample on it." It's the birthday of science writer Jonathan Weiner, New York City, 1953, author of The Beak of the Finch, a story of evolution in our time, and his most recent book about attempts to achieve immortality, a book entitled Long for This World. And it's the birthday of the cartoonist Charles Schulz, born in Minneapolis, 1922. His father was a barber, supported the family on 35-cent haircuts. Every Sunday, the boy and his father read the funny pages together. The boy hoped to become a cartoonist, but he had a rough time in school, felt picked on by teachers, other students. His cartoons were not even accepted by the high school yearbook. He was drafted into the Army. His mother died of cancer a couple of days before he left home. When he came back, he moved in with his father in the apartment above the barbershop and started drawing a cartoon strip for the local paper called Little Folks. He fell in love with a red-haired woman. They dated for a while. He asked her to marry him. She turned him down and soon after married someone else. Schulz was bitter about it for the rest of his life. But in 1950, the first Peanuts cartoon strip appeared in national papers, introducing Charlie Brown, and then Snoopy, and then the rest over the years, Linus, Lucy, Schroeder, Pigpen, Peppermint Patty, and Charlie Brown's Unrequited Love, known simply as The Little Red-Haired Girl. Charles Schulz, who said, "My whole life has been one of rejection. Women, dogs, comic strips." Here's a poem for today by William Stafford, entitled Any Morning. Just lying on the couch and being happy, only humming a little the quiet sound in the head. Trouble is busy elsewhere. At the moment, it has so much to do in the world. People who might judge are mostly asleep. They can't monitor you all the time. And sometimes they forget. When dawn flows over the hedge, you can get up and act busy. Little corners like this, pieces of heaven left lying around, can be picked up and saved. People won't even see that you have them. They're so light and easy to hide. Later in the day, you can act like the others. You can shake your head. You can frown. A poem by William Stafford, Any Morning, from The Way It Is, published by Grey Wolf Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses improve what potential customers find online in search engines and review sites. Learn more at Reputation.com. Written by Betsy Allister, produced by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for KUAF comes from Heartwood Gallery, hosting a holiday open house and 10th anniversary celebration Saturday, December 1st, from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. at 428 South Government Street in Fayetteville. Works from 30 local artists will be available. Refreshments and entertainment will be provided. HeartwoodGallery.org or 444-0888. For more information, support also comes from Eureka Springs, the Victorian Mountain Village, featuring art, music, dining, lodging, various attractions, and outdoor activities. Information, including a visitor's vacation planner, an events calendar, newsletter registration, and more, available on the web at eurekasprings.org. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Kingston. I'm Kyle Kellums. Another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow. I know that on Friday, I promised that today we'd give away the last two tickets to Billy Elliot, which will be at Walton Arts Center beginning next week. We will do that. We'll have the question tomorrow, guaranteed. Not enough time to do it again today, but we will do that tomorrow. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with another brand new edition. Have a great Monday.